there is a new movie that, if it has not already been released, it is about to be released. And it stars two big headliners that everyone knows, Meryl Streep and Jack Nicholson. And the movie is called Heartburn. I don't know if you've read or seen anything about it. And the plot revolves around a wife who's sitting in the beauty parlor listening to the chit-chat of some of the promiscuity of some of the other customers' husbands, and it prompts her to rush home and start rummaging through dresser drawers to indeed find evidence of what she had been suspecting all along, that her husband was being unfaithful. Now, a lot of movies have carried that kind of a theme, but this one happens to be based upon a book that was written by the wife of one of the two figures who was very prominent in the journalism of the Watergate scandal. Some of you weren't even born during the Watergate scandal, but for those that were around in those days, the names Woodward and Bernstein, you will recall, they together wrote the book All the President's Men about that entire scandal. Well, 4 years into their marriage and being pregnant with her second child, Bernstein's wife discovered that he was having an affair with the wife of the British ambassador there in Washington, D.C. When they split up, Bernstein proclaimed to the press, "My wife and I both have always had a policy of keeping our private life out of the public eye." But apparently his wife wasn't listening, because she went on to write a novel about his indiscretion and about the entire heartache or heartburn of their marriage, which ended because of his infidelity. People magazine did their own poll on the status of adultery in America. And when asked divorced or separated spouses why they left their mates, the majority cited infidelity, which rated higher than physical abuse or even poor intimacy in marriage. Nearly 70% of the respondents to this People magazine poll believe that you don't actually have to commit a sexual act to be unfaithful. Lust in your heart is, they say, itself a naughty notion. Interesting that that would be the response of some of the population at large. And other sociological studies have shown that during the last 30 years, the percentage of men who have been unfaithful in their marriage vows has remained fairly steady. And that is about one-half to two-thirds indulge in at least one extramarital affair. But the number of promiscuous females, however, is on the increase. Back in the 50s, it was estimated that between 6 and 25% of married women had been unfaithful. Now that number ranges between 21 and 54%. The firm of Audits and Surveys Incorporated interviewed 750 households about how adults feel about love, marriage, and infidelity. And of course, a lot of people think it's just par for the course. We've become accustomed to it, to even expect it. Apparently, from what I've read, Meryl Streep's character in the movie Heartburn approaches her father about the infidelity she's learned about her husband, to which her father says to her, "You want monogamy? Marry a swan." And that's probably not too far from the way a lot of people think. I'm not going to throw a lot of statistics at you, but just a small bit of the questions that were asked among these 750 households. One, is it possible to be romantically in love with two people at the same time? 58% said yes. Another question, are people with strong religious beliefs less likely to be unfaithful to their spouses? Again, 58% said yes. Another question, if they thought they could get away with it, would most married men and women have an extramarital affair? Most said yes. Question, is it lust or love that prompts most people to commit adultery? 83% said it was lust. Finally, many married people never have an extramarital affair. What stops them? Most respondents think it's a combination of being happily married and taking their marriage vows seriously. That's good to hear. 14% said it's a matter of money. The faithful can't afford it. And then 11% said it's because they don't have the energy. Now, you know, I laughed at that. I mean, adultery is not a laughing matter, but there was something about just not having the energy that struck me a little humorous. I mean, the effort it takes, and if sometimes life gets so overwhelming. How do you have time beyond your job and your family as it is for anything like that? If People magazine had been in circulation back in the first century, the survey questions would have been just as relevant. Although the infidelity among pious Jewish leaders had the cloak of spirituality and religious zeal, and thus the Sermon on the Mount continues here in Matthew chapter 5, picking up with verse 27, remembering that what Jesus is doing here is that following his statement in verse 20 of chapter 5, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven." And then he then begins in verse 21 to give a list of six life situations where he is comparing the mistaken approach by the religious leaders with what should be the true biblical understanding and approach to these various life situations. And as we come down to verse 27 through 32, he touches on two of them, one, adultery, and the second, divorce. Follow along as I read verses 27 through 32. Jesus went on to say, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you, for it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. If your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you, for it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. It was said, 'Whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce.' But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the reason of unchastity, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery." So even though he doesn't go into a lot of detail, he does address first the issue of the sin of marital infidelity in verses 27 through 30, and then he addresses the possible sin of divorce in verses 31 and 32. Looking first at the sin of marital infidelity, he states the Old Testament prohibition against adultery, which of course is the seventh of the Ten Commandments. And in fact, when we went through the Ten Commandments last year, it was in early September that we addressed commandment number seven, "Thou shalt not commit adultery." And so I commend that to you on our website if you would like to go and listen to that message, because I was more detailed there than I intend to be this morning for the sake of time. But I would remind you of something I said last September, and that is that the prohibition of adultery that Jesus is quoting there is mentioned so often in all of the Old Testament scriptures that there's only one other sin that is mentioned more often, and that's the sin of idolatry. The term for adultery in the Old Testament, in its strictest sense, and primarily the way it appears in the Hebrew Bible, refers to the unlawful intercourse with the spouse of someone else. Now, I said primarily because the word also in the Hebrew text can from time to time be used in a general way to talk about any kind of illicit sexual activity. And I believe that's what Jesus does here, as he enlarges beyond adultery itself, moikeia, which is the word he uses for adultery here. But then when he talks about unchastity here and in Matthew 19, where there's more detail given to this statement here, he uses a more general term, porneia, which means any kind of unlawful sexual intercourse. Adultery prohibited. It is a sin, certainly against the spouse, but primarily it's a sin against God. It is violating that creation ordinance that he had given in Genesis of marriage. That's why the rabbis called it a great sin. You recall when Abraham encountered a local king and was afraid that their lives might be in danger, so he lied and said that Sarah was his sister, and the king took her into his harem. But the text tells us in Genesis 20 that God intervened sovereignly and didn't allow that king to actually have relations with Sarah. And in fact, the king speaks to him in a dream and says, I didn't allow you to commit this sin against me. When Joseph is being seduced by Potiphar's wife, he states over in Genesis 39, how could I do this great sin against God? Adultery in Leviticus 20 carried the death penalty, whereas the death penalty was not given for many other acts of immorality, but for adultery it was. And as I said, it breaks the very marriage ordinance, one of God's covenants. You know, and it's interesting, too, that of all the sins that could be mentioned, it's violating the marriage covenant is the one that is primarily used in the Old Testament to describe the sin of dishonoring God and violating his covenant that he has with his people. Thus, we have this theme of spiritual harlotry or spiritual adultery describing the Israelites and their unfaithfulness to God. And several of the prophets pick up on that theme. But certainly, in addition to being a sin against God, adultery is a sin against one's spouse. It's the breaking of a promise. It's the violation of a sacred trust. It is a rupture of the most intimate relationship between a man and a woman. That physical oneness is shattered by this act. As he's concluding his letter to the Hebrews, the writer states in Hebrews 13:4, let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled, for fornicators and adulterers God will judge. And certainly, if there's children in the home, it's also a sin against the children. And throughout my pastoral life, and perhaps this has been your experience, Brad, that I've counseled many adult children who still limp from the wounds of the divorce that took place between their parents due to infidelity. But it's also a sin against oneself. We're told that we're sinning against our own bodies. I think I read these in the sermon last September, but they bear repeating in case you weren't with us. In Proverbs, which has a lot to say about sexual purity, one place he states, drink water from your own cistern, that was a carved out cavern in the rock where they would collect rainwater. Drink water from your own cistern and fresh water from your own well. Should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets? He's being discreet in talking about promiscuity here. Let them be yours alone and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. For why should you, my son, be exhilarated with an adulteress and embrace the bosom of a foreigner? For the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he watches all his paths. His own iniquities will capture the wicked, and he will be held with the cords of his sin. He will die for lack of instruction, and in the greatness of his folly, he will go astray. That was in Proverbs 5. A few more verses from Proverbs. Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Or can a man walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? So is the one who goes in to his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her will not go unpunished. The one who commits adultery with a woman is lacking sense. He who would destroy himself does it. Wounds and disgrace he will find, and his reproach will not be blotted out. That was in Proverbs 6. Well, much like Jesus had done when we were looking at the issue of murder, and he went beyond the act of murder to the kind of anger and mean words that are expressed that lead up to that. So here, Jesus does not allow us or his hearers at the time to linger in some kind of pharisaical type of self-righteous comfort zone. Because now he steps back and addresses the source, the root, the origin of adultery. And we read it, and most of you know it well. Everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery in his heart. Jesus' indictment here is quite specific as to what is taking place. Verse 28 says, looks on a woman. New American Standard says, with lust for her, but actually it would probably be better translated, looks on a woman to lust for her. We have here the word blepo, to look, is a present participle. It carries the idea of continuing to look. It's gazing and looking in order to lust. So what he's referring to here is not the inadvertent glance or the accidental awareness, but rather it is the purposeful look. There's nothing innocent about the man in Jesus' statement here. And notice when the adultery takes place, with her already. One Christian pastor that I was reading in one of his books, I thought had a helpful little paragraph when he said, it's so critical to understand that our sexual drive and desires is not the same as lust. And he goes on to observe, and I agree with him, it's not lust to be attracted to someone or notice that he or she is good looking. It's not lust to have a strong desire to have sex. This grows as we grow older, and it's part of what drives us towards marriage and procreation. It's not lust to anticipate and be excited about having sex within marriage. It's not lust when a man or woman becomes turned on without any conscious decision to do so. It's not lust to experience, and catch this last one, it is not lust to experience sexual temptation. There is a difference between the temptation and embracing the act. So as I've looked at this language as carefully as I know how and have consulted those who are much more skilled in biblical languages than I am, I've concluded that Jesus is addressing the stare, the leer, the second look, the going on down the road of fantasizing, those mental musings that would be immoral if they were acted out. And certainly any kind of pornography or other medium that entices us to commit immoral acts in our minds. Quoting from yet another writer, he observes this, a man's lust leads him to detach a woman's body from her soul, mind, and person, and use her for the sake of his selfish pleasure. Isn't this why most pornography is directed toward men and depicts women presenting themselves solely for a man's pleasure? Pornography reinforces the lie that women are sexual playthings for men's enjoyment, that women want to be used, not loved and cherished. And then I think he rightly observes that, of course, a woman can be tempted by lust in a similar way. But lust doesn't seem to come quite as naturally to a woman. What does come naturally is a desire for intimacy. So when a woman sees a seductive ad featuring a man, she might be tempted to fantasize about sex with him, but the odds are that this temptation will be rooted in fantasy about a relationship with him, with physical pleasure being a subset of her craving for passionate attention and emotional intimacy. Dr. Al Mohler, who's the president of Southern Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, and he is admired and appreciated by many within the under the umbrella of Orthodox Christianity. He makes a statement, and I'm going to read it to you, but as I do, I'm reminded of something that I heard Chuck Swindoll say many years ago, that part of the role of the pastor is to comfort the afflicted and at times afflict the comfortable. Al Mohler once made a shocking yet accurate statement, quote, "Men are tempted to give themselves to pornography. Women are tempted to commit pornography. If you're a woman, you don't have to pose for a picture or star in a pornographic movie to commit pornography. When you dress and behave in a way that is designed primarily to arouse sexual desire in men, you're committing pornography with your life." It's because of those realities that I, in my estimation, think that some churches, some schools and institutions, and in a desire to guard and protect sexual propriety, go too far when they want to stand at the door with a ruler and measure skirt lengths and all the rest of it. So I certainly don't endorse imposing some kind of legalistic dress code, but I do make the appeal to my brothers and sisters in Christ that we need to be attentive to how we dress and what signal it sends, whether men or women are wearing their clothes tighter for the purpose of looking more alluring. When a sister in Christ decides on a length of a dress or the shortness of a dress, or when we make the conscious decision to unbutton one button or two or three, why are we doing that? And I'll never understand what appears to me to be the silly habit of a good number of guys in our culture that just insist that 6 inches of their underwear is going to be showing above their belt. But we need to take responsibility and being sensitive to one another in this area. Of course, one of the things that fuels all of this is certainly the media, television, movies, internet. And I really appreciated the transparency of Joshua Harris, who used to be the pastor up in Maryland, and now he's resigned and gone back to school, actually. He wrote in a little subchapter called Poison Pills. He said, "Here's the mistake I often made. I know that media contains a certain amount of sinful content that is dangerous. But instead of seeing how much I can avoid, I spend my energy trying to see how much I can handle. I'm like a person who figures out he can take half a poison pill every day without killing himself. It's good that he's not dying, but can it be healthy to take all those halves of poison pills?" That's what I was doing one night in a DVD store. Instead of saying, "God, I want to honor you. I don't want to put something before my eyes that celebrates sin," I was saying, "Sin isn't that big a deal. I can take it in small doses." All those half doses of poison are adding up and swimming in my blood. We need to examine the cumulative effect of our media habits on our attitude toward God, toward sin, and toward the world. Obviously, we all know we should avoid graphic sex scenes in movies and television, but we also need to make sure the constant barrage of seemingly harmless entertainment is not trivializing sin. Just because someone doesn't watch R-rated movies doesn't mean that he's necessarily safe. It would be so easy if we just said, yeah, to PG, maybe to PG-13, never to the R, when you know as well as I do, if you go to the movies like I do, that any one of those three can be offensive at one point or another, whether through innuendo or a blatant, gratuitous display. John Wesley, along with his brother Charles, who established Methodism, his mother, Susanna, had 19 children, I think 10 or 11 lived to adulthood. But when John was in college, he wrote a letter to his mother asking her to give him a clear description of sin. I think what he was probably looking for was just, tell me the things to do and the things not to do, just do's and don'ts. But Susanna Wesley did not give her son what he was asking for, but she did give him something that is much better. In part, this is what she wrote to him. Take this rule. Whatever weakens your reason, impairs the tenderness of your conscience, obscures your sense of God, or takes off the relish of spiritual things. In short, whatever increases the strength and authority of your body over your mind, that thing is sin to you, however innocent it may be in itself. Advice given hundreds of years ago, advice as relevant today. You know, it's interesting that the role of theater, of the stage, of plays, of dramas, even back in the second, third, and fourth centuries, there were Christian leaders speaking out against the immorality of what was going on. Tertullian wrote against it. Chrysostom, in fact, wrote these very words. He lived in the 300s AD. For whence are they, tell me, that plot against our marriages? Is it not from this theater? Whence are they that dig through into bedchambers? Is it not from that stage? So that the subverter of all things is he that goes to the theater. It is he that brings in a grievous tyranny. Those of you that know me know well, I am not suggesting we should never go to a movie, go to the theater. But I am saying, and I was convicted about this myself in my own life and just preparing this message, we don't want to let down our guard of just sort of getting more comfortable with things because in the culture it's so prevalent, and to really be attentive to what is it doing to our spiritual zeal, our soul, our sense of purity. Because an extended family member used to get Victoria's Secret, she was a female, catalog, and then gave our address as a temporary address when they moved, they still come to my house. Two came the other day. In the same day, two came. I immediately grabbed them and threw them out in the recycle bin in my garage. Did it occur to me to open it up? Absolutely. The cover was bad enough. It's bad enough to walk through the mall, in my opinion, and even look at the window. I remember once, it made no difference, but I felt better about it. When my boys were coming up through elementary and middle school, that's when Victoria's Secret opened in the mall, and I was so offended, I actually wrote the district manager saying, who wants to walk through the mall with their 11-year-old son and see these women that are not half-naked, nine-tenths naked there in the window? Well, that's not our decision. It's national, blah, blah, blah. I felt better that I tried. You remember Job said this in Job 31? And, you know, some think that Job is actually the oldest book in the Bible. I have made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin? Does he not see my ways and number all my steps? If my heart has been enticed by a woman, or I have lurked at my neighbor's doorway, may my wife grind for another and let others kneel down over her. For that would be a lustful crime. Moreover, it would be an iniquity punishable by judges. For it would be fire that consumes and would uproot all my increase. Jesus goes on, speaking certainly with hyperbole. He's obviously not suggesting that we literally surgically remove a hand or gouge out an eye. But what Jesus does instruct us with this figure of speech here in verses 29 and 30 is that we should seek to be looking at our lives and eliminating whatever we sense is causing us to sin. And it's not the same for all of us. We all don't have the same level of temptation in every area. I read one man in one of the books I was reading this week made the statement, well, it's become that season where I stare at the sidewalk, you know, because it's summer. When I was in college at the University of Florida, for a period of time, I just wouldn't walk across the Plaza of America. Why? Because everybody's sunbathing. It was just easier to take the long way around. And do you have your computer in a place where everybody in the house can see it? I know men who have their computer screens facing the door so anybody walking by can see what's on the screen. Paul says to the Romans in Romans 13, 14, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh in regard to its lusts. And so when I read verses 29 and 30, the question I have to ask myself and I ask you to ask yourselves is, are we being radical enough? Are we, figuratively speaking, willing to gouge out the eye and cut off the hand for the sake of avoiding that which would entice us? Verses 31 and 32, the possible sin of divorce. There was, in Jesus' day, general unanimity among the Jews that divorce was allowed due to the teaching of Moses back in Deuteronomy chapter 24, where he made provision for divorce. But in Jesus' day, there was really a conflict between two rabbinic schools. There were two schools of thought about life in general, but about divorce in particular. There was the one school, the school of Shammai, that interpreted Deuteronomy 24 with the utmost strictness, that the indecency that Moses mentions in Deuteronomy 24, that a man can divorce his wife for an indecency, that is referring specifically to immorality and adultery. And a woman could be wicked and evil in a lot of other areas of life, but if she committed that sin, it merited him divorcing her. The other school that differed with Shammai was the school of Hillel. And it, as in most things, interpreted the phrase much more freely, so that the way things evolved through the teaching of Hillel and their laxity, just about anything a husband found displeasing about his wife was legitimate grounds for divorce. And so true examples from the written histories of the time is that a Jewish man could divorce his wife if she spoiled a dish of food, if she spun or would weave in the streets, which was something that prostitutes typically did to attract men, if she talked to a strange man, if she spoke disrespectfully of in-laws within the husband's hearing, if she was what they called a brawling woman, which simply meant she was so loud the neighbors could hear her and what she was saying and talking about. Women, at least within the Jewish community, were in a most vulnerable position, and they were abused as a consequence. In the Jewish society of Palestine, women practically had no legal rights. A man could divorce his wife with or without her consent. But a woman could only divorce her husband with his consent. And if I've read correctly, there were three grounds in which a woman could divorce the husband within Judaism. One was if he became a leper, if he had ravished a virgin, and if he had falsely accused her of some prenuptial sin. The rabbis became practically attorneys in drawing up the papers and the fine print, and it had to be recorded with the Sanhedrin. But on the whole, the process was relatively easy, and for the most part, was entirely at the discretion of the man. And as far as the interpretation of Deuteronomy 24 about the indecency, and we're not real sure what that indecency is. It seems to refer to some kind of nakedness or exposure of a thing. Loosely, that she was guilty of having done something that was considered unseemly, even if short of actual adultery. Kind of a catch-all term for something strikingly embarrassing to the husband. Of course, human nature being what it is, with the laxity, the looseness gained more and more ground, so that people were putting away their wives for the most trivial of reasons. And thus the women were the victims of immoral and sensitive men, and all with the approval of the religious establishment. So going back to 5:20, your righteousness must exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees. Okay, when it comes to divorce, you can't approach divorce the way these religious leaders, I sort of say bozos, the way these religious leaders were handling divorce. That's why a few chapters later, where Matthew gives a more detailed response by Jesus about divorce and remarriage, here it's just the two verses. They come to him with what obviously was a test question, hoping that he would contradict himself or maybe even get in trouble with Herod Antipas the way John the Baptist did, and he lost his head for declaring his marriage to be a sham and immoral. Even better, they probably hoped they could find Jesus in the trap of having disagreed with Moses. But if you go and read Matthew 19 sometime before the day is out, you'll find he counters their question with his own question. But what Jesus does say to them over in Matthew 19, we won't take the time to turn there now, but he acknowledges in verse 31 of Matthew 5, he quotes, "Give her a certificate of divorce." But this concession, and it was that, it was a concession, it was an accommodation of human weakness. It was an attempt to bring some kind of order in a society that had abandoned God's standards for marriage. God did not institute divorce. He allowed for it due to their obstinate refusal to embrace God's view of marriage. And in some ways, Deuteronomy 24, 1-4 was not so much to provide the right to divorce for a man as much as a provision of protection for the woman, because it did allow for her to remarry. And it protected her from being passed back and forth on some whim. The Pharisees had become so preoccupied with stretching and abusing the provision for divorce that they had lost sight of God's original intention for marriage from the beginning. And that's where, especially in Matthew 19, Jesus goes back to the very creation ordinance itself, the very purpose. So there is this divorce, though, that can be permissible because of the except clause, as it's called here. Everyone who divorces his wife, except for the reason of unchastity. And so Jesus is acknowledging and is teaching at this point that there is one situation where divorce can be pursued rightly in God's sight, and it's if the partner has been unfaithful, has been guilty of porneia, unlawful sexual intercourse. By the way, the except clause is not to be seen as a loophole to quickly get out of a marriage that one doesn't like. Jesus talks about when divorce can be sinful. And the one thing he addresses here is that if a marriage is dissolved for non-legitimate or unbiblical reasons, then what happens is that because a marriage relationship has not been properly dissolved, then any future relationships and marriages creates an adulterous situation for the person who has left the marriage and for anyone else they marry. Why? Because another sexual union is taking place when a prior one has not been dissolved. A couple of interesting things about Jesus' teaching at this point is that he acknowledges and assumes, as most people did, that a remarriage will take place. In rabbinic Judaism, a woman could commit adultery against her husband. A man could commit adultery against another man's wife. A man was never spoken of as having committed adultery against his wife. But here Jesus is putting the man under the same moral obligation as the wife. So in Jewish law, to restate, a wife was for the most part not allowed to divorce her husband. That's why Matthew doesn't mention wives divorcing their husbands, because within Judaism you didn't do that, and Matthew's audience was mainly Jewish. Now, if you go over to Mark's gospel, his audience is Roman. There, Jesus is quoted as saying if a man divorces his wife or if the wife divorces the husband, because in his audience that did take place with a lot of Gentiles. Let me make a few other observations about this exception, this when divorce is permissible. It is permissible, not mandatory, even if there's been adultery. With the New Testament teaching of forgiveness and restoration when encountering sin, this is an exception clause, not to be seen as an escape clause. The porneia that Jesus speaks of in Matthew 5:32, I believe, is a repeated and unrepented of, not necessarily an isolated incident. If the repeated sexual sin is a permissible ground for divorce, it must mean that the actual sin of breaking the marriage union is not charged against the innocent party. It's the sexual offender who's broken the union. I have had the blessing and the encouragement of seeing more than a few marriages where adultery has been committed by one partner or the other, to only see the offended partner forgive and for them to restore the marriage and go on to be married, in some cases for decades now. That's my goal, to the extent that I have any ability to speak into the situation, is that even though it's permissible, I'll repeat, it's not mandatory. Hopefully there can be forgiveness and restoration. If you would like to see because there's other issues about divorce that Jesus doesn't address here. Obviously in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul states it clearly. The Lord didn't address this, but I'm addressing this. There's other situations and circumstances that Jesus doesn't address. And so the Apostle Paul does, and even in our culture, there's yet even other circumstances that nothing in Scripture directly addresses, then we're left with discernment and a judgment call as the people of God. And if you want to go to our website, I have a series of what are called position papers, where it was my purpose to give a one-page front and back. I think on divorce I made it really small print to fit on one page, but where I just give my basic position on several questions that I'm asked about all the time. And I have one there on divorce. Because in addition to infidelity, I believe that divorce is permissible when there's desertion by a partner. And desertion can mean more, of course, than just physically leaving the residence. There can be all kinds of physical and emotional abuse, a failure to take care of the family and meet its most basic needs. But if a Christian finds themselves in a crisis marriage and they think divorce is an option, that decision needs to be made in counsel with the spiritual leaders of one's local church. One's pastors and elders should be praying with and guiding people through such a decision. And of course, there is the danger that we look for an easy way out. We certainly don't want to be a party to minimizing wedding vows when they're made. And for better or for worse, till death do us part, that's what we aim for. And so I've had a few people in my pastoral journey get very angry with me because they've come to me and wanted me to kind of give my blessing to a divorce, and in good conscience I couldn't. And so they've gotten very angry with me because I didn't believe they really had biblical grounds. I've lost track now. I've been a pastor 38 or 39 years. And I have to tell you guys, from my experience, divorce and remarriage is the single most difficult thing I've confronted as a pastor. It is the most difficult. And I don't think I have to tell you why. Because it involves men and women and their children. It involves their lives, the hurt, the anguish, the sin. And it's devastating. It is truly devastating. Which is why no spiritual leader or pastor should ever be cavalier or pharisaical in how we approach these situations. I've been accused of being everything from being legalistic and strict to being a liberal on this issue, depending on whether people like my counsel or not. Chuck Swindoll, and I think I put this at the end of my position paper, he says, where God permits divorce and remarriage, humbly let us accept it without fear or guilt. Let us not call unclean what he now calls clean, but neither let us put words in his mouth and make him say what he in fact has not said. No matter how miserable we may be, there is something much worse than living with a mate in disharmony. It is living with God in disobedience. And as I've already mentioned in passing, it's not only devastating for the husband and wife involved, the impact that it has on the children. It should not surprise us that the rates of divorce amongst the grown children of parents who are divorced is pretty high. And I just learned something the other day. I have a lot to learn still. I'm speaking of World War II. But Franklin Delano Roosevelt, one of the most famous presidents because he guided our country through World War II, he and his wife had five children that grew to adulthood. I didn't know this till just recently, and I was doing some reading. And if you know anything about Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, he carried on an extramarital affair for decades. And in fact, Eleanor was devastated to learn that when he finally died at Warm Springs, Georgia, his mistress was with him. And her daughter went ahead and told her that. And the daughter knew and just helped keep her dad's secret from her mom. So they did not have a healthy marriage. They had a politically convenient marriage. But if I could just quickly, as our time has elapsed, the oldest one, Anna, she got married, separated from her husband. During the separation, had an affair with a journalist who she then married after she divorced her husband, and the journalist divorced his wife. She was married to him for 14 years, and she divorced him and married a third time. Second child, James, he married wife number one, had two daughters. Married, got divorced. Married wife number two, had two sons and a daughter, divorced her. Married wife number three, his receptionist, and had one son, divorced her. married wife number four, his son's teacher, and had one daughter. Child number three, Elliot Roosevelt. Married wife number one, had one daughter and one son, divorced. Married wife number two, had two sons and one daughter, divorced. Married wife number three, divorced. Married wife number four, divorced. Married wife number five, had a daughter who died as an infant. Child number four, FDR Jr. Married wife number one, had two sons, divorced. Married wife number two, had two daughters, divorced. Married wife number three, divorced. Wife number four, had one son, divorced. And married wife number five. The youngest, John, married wife number one, had a son and three daughters, divorced, and then married wife number two. If you're doing the math, the second son had seven children by four mothers. The next son, Elliot, had six children by three mothers. FDR Jr. had five kids by three moms. Amongst these five children, there were 14 divorces amongst these five children. And where did they learn that? Where we all learn the most fundamental things in life, and it's the house we grow up in. I found that devastating. I wasn't even reading something about marriage and divorce. I happened to be reading about Roosevelt and just thought, my gosh, these divorces. And I started kind of calculating it here. But because of the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ, and because he can make things new, and because he can bring restoration, and because he does forgive fully and restore fully, we are not destined to limp the rest of our lives with any of these sins that may occur in our lives. But God, help us to remain repentant. And God, help us to keep seeking him who can restore. And if he's restored, we need to honor that. One of my mentors, Mike Braun, that some of you know, wrote a book, University Press published it years ago, called Second Class Christians, subtitled, Are Divorced People Second Class Christians in the Church? And of course, the resounding answer is no. And he goes on to lay out a very biblical rationale for that.